It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Lots to cover.
Fine day for a walk.
I hope so.
For a long walk from the Seattle Center to downtown.
Well, that's assuming you start at the Seattle Center. There are actually things starting before that, and maybe we should explain what we're talking about.
Yes, why don't we?
Yeah, Jav, why don't you start?
Well, there's a march today. Today is the second anniversary of the invasion, the unprovoked invasion, which I think is, you know, sort of something you need to automatically tag onto that. It's not just the beginning of the war. It's the beginning of the invasion and the beginning of the unprovoked invasion of Iraq. And for that reason, there are demonstrations all over the world today, including here in Seattle. And the one here in Seattle begins at noon with feeder marches, as Mike was saying, from various places. The rally begins at noon at Seattle Center, the plaza in the middle of the center, and then at 1:30 there will be a march downtown and then back to the center. So that'll be a nice long hike, and hopefully the rain will hold off and people can be roused to get up and not watch basketball all day.
As so many of our listeners do.
Yes.
All right. And probably best to dress in layers since we don't know what the weather's going to do.
But I really do think there's going to be a good turnout today. This is a demonstration that there's been a lot of talk about and a lot of organizing around for several months now. So I think it'll be probably the most sizable anti-war rally since the beginning of the war, I believe.
Well, and we had several representatives of labor on earlier this morning, and there's going to be a healthy labor contingent. I know that. So.
Yeah, leaving from 11:30 at the beginning at the SEIU headquarters at 150 Denny Way. That's where that feeder march is coming from.
Very good. All right. Well, I spotted in this morning's paper, the Times, and I understand it's in both papers, that apparently there's a new U.S. policy they've come up with for
I don't know if it's new, actually.
Or maybe they're just announcing it finally.
Yeah.
More military intervention instead of less.
It's the Pentagon released its National Defense Strategy of the United States.
And this is a document that they have to release to Congress every year, right?
I think so, yeah. And this year, if you open up your PI, if you open up the newspaper this morning and you look at the articles on it, the PI in particular has an article called Pentagon Calls, quote, Strategy of Weak, quote, end quote, a challenge to the U.S. And what that article is about is it's about some of the wording in the defense policy that was released. And some of that wording puts in the same sentence diplomacy and international law, puts it in the same sentence with terrorism as a threat to the U.S. Now, this is something that we've gotten hints of in the last two or three years, that the Bush administration does not like to engage in diplomacy or international law, does not like the concept of international law. And this document really puts it into perspective that they don't just not like it, they view it as an actual outright threat.
And this is the official foreign policy of the United States at this point.
It's the official defense policy. Yep. Yes. Uh-huh. And it's kind of interesting. The person who framed this document would have been Douglas Feith, the Undersecretary for Policy at the Pentagon. He's a noted neoconservative, one of the really ultra right-wing guys in the Bush administration, in the civilian end of the Pentagon, who you could pretty squarely lay the blame for the invasion of Iraq and the mess that's occurred afterwards.
So he's going to go to the IMF next, right?
What with his boss, Paul Wolfowitz, the number two man at the Pentagon, going to the World Bank.
Right.
You want to talk about that a little bit, Jeff?
Yeah, he's Wolfowitz, the number two man at the Pentagon, is going to the World Bank, following in the fine footsteps of Robert McNamara in the late '60s, early '70s. This is an appointment that is, as with John Bolton a couple weeks ago, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, an appointment that has been met with sort of gasps of horror by the diplomatic community around the world. One more point of evidence is why diplomacy has to be considered a threat to United States foreign policy, I guess. It really is kind of frightening when you have a guy who, among other things, has been very much in the camp of selling U.S. arms to third world countries, now put in a position where he's going to be able to broker those kind of deals full time. that the World Bank is very much in the business of setting up financing for quote-unquote development programs to the third world. But the problem with that is that under many of the strictures of the WTO, the World Bank, the IMF, third world countries are really discouraged from spending money on social programs, on infrastructure, on safety nets. What they're encouraged to spend money on is weapons, and particularly the weapons of the United States, but also the weapons of Europe and other weapons manufacturers. And this is something that is going to be brought to the fore by the Wolfowitz appointment, I think. It's really quite disturbing.
And Wolfowitz has absolutely no experience, as far as I can tell, from looking at his resume and reading these glowing reviews of who this man is. You know, his only experience of even living in a developing nation was 2 years spent in Indonesia as ambassador there.
Although he's very fond of that experience, he touts it a lot as being as being something that was really a turning point in his life.
It forms a very tiny piece of a very, very long history in government and in universities teaching defense policy and foreign strategy. He has also, what I find really puzzling, is that he has absolutely no finance or banking experience. And generally, people who are put up for the head of the World Bank have at least some experience as an economist or working as bank or sitting on
board. It is, after all, a bank.
Yeah, or sitting on the board of a bank or, you know, just something like that. And he has absolutely nothing, not one speck of experience in finance, which is interesting. If you also look at some of the quotes that he gave for the prior to the invasion of Iraq, when he said, for example, that the invasion of Iraq is a country that could support itself, that could support its own reconstruction with its oil revenue. We'll talk about that a little bit later when I get into this week in Iraq, how close the government of Iraq is to being able to do that right now. Clearly, it's not doing it. And the U.S. government has had to pour, you know, billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars into Iraq reconstruction, which is stalled right now.
So this was
the insurgency. He had no concept that this could happen.
This is the one economic forecast that he's actually made.
Yeah, this is the one economic forecast that he's made that's well known, and it's been an absolute disaster.
Well, and getting back to your comment about his experience in Indonesia, for those that aren't familiar, the Indonesian military has just been brutal over the years. I mean, to put it mildly, and going to East Timor and wiping out a third of the population there.
Yeah, and Aceh province
and
as well.
And the U.S. Pentagon considers the Indonesian military as a good partner. I mean, it's the Pentagon who has protested all this time that Congress forced them to stop cooperating with the Indonesian military and giving military aid to what was one of the most brutal and is still one of the most brutal militaries in the world.
Yeah, they don't particularly embrace diplomacy either.
Or democracy.
All right. Well, you mentioned this week in Iraq, so why don't we go there?
Yes, the Iraqi parliament, the new Iraqi parliament, met on the 16th. That was Wednesday of this past week. But did they get anything done? Well, not really. They got together and they swore in their members. They listened to some verses from the Quran, and then they had a big party, and then they adjourned. Now, that's kind of interesting, given that all of the members of the parliament who had been elected on January 30th had said that they wanted to get together and form a new government, which would have meant taking a vote on a new president, two vice presidents, and a speaker of parliament. They did absolutely none of that. In fact, they didn't even set a new date for a second session. And so now we're hearing various dates for the second session. Maybe it'll be on the 24th, maybe the 26th, maybe in a couple of weeks. So nobody even knows when the new parliament is going to meet again. That's kind of interesting. The negotiations over forming the new government have stalled over the issue of Kirkuk. We talked about this last week, how the Kurds are holding out for the city of Kirkuk and its oil reserves to be declared part of the Kurdish Autonomous Region. And also the Kurds are holding out to retain the control of their Peshmerga militia and not have it be swallowed up by the Iraqi army. So because the Kurds are holding out on those two things, the Shiites have not been able to get together with them and form a two-thirds majority to vote on a new president and vice president. And that president and vice president would sit down and make a new make a presidency council, and then they would appoint a prime minister who would form a government. That whole process is stalled right now because the Kurds are holding out for that bit of real estate, that very, very expensive and very, very oil-rich bit of real estate that the Iraqi government does not want to cede control of. There was another bit of news today, or news this week about Iraq. We talked last week, in the last 2 weeks, about the shooting of Giuliana Sgrena and Nicola Calipari, the Italian journalist and the intelligence officer who negotiated her release. She had been kidnapped and he had negotiated her release. They were shot at a U.S. checkpoint on the way to Baghdad International Airport. Now, this week, we've heard that Silvio Berlusconi, the Prime Minister of Italy, has said that Italian troops are going to be coming out of Iraq. Italy is going to leave the coalition of the willing starting in September. Also, this week, Bulgaria announced that they were going to be leaving Iraq this year, too. This comes days after U.S. troops shot and killed a Bulgarian soldier who was a member of the coalition. Now,
so we're just picking them off one by one. Is this what you're saying?
We are. Italy and Bulgaria are joining some other countries that have deserted recently. Poland has announced that it's going to pull out its troops. So has the Ukraine. Let's just review for a minute who's left in the coalition of the willing.
Oh, good. This won't take long.
No, it won't take long. The largest member is Britain with about 8,850 troops. And then you get down to South Korea with about 3,600 troops. And then beneath that, what's left are countries that have less than 1,000 troops in Iraq. Australia with 900, Romania with 800, Japan with 600, Denmark with 500. And then when you get under the 500 level, you've got about 14 different countries, which altogether have about 1,500 troops there. Countries including El Salvador, Mongolia, Azerbaijan, Slovakia, Tonga. I don't even really know where Tonga is.
and why it would need an army.
Yeah, I know why it would need an army. It's got about 40 people there. Georgia, and we're not talking about the state of Georgia, by the way. The state of Georgia has many, many, many more kids over in Iraq than most of these countries that belong to the Coalition of the Willing have. So that's what's left of our so-called international coalition in Iraq. And I want to tell you, I also have a few more numbers for you. It's 2 years after the invasion of Iraq, and it might be worthwhile looking at the economic indicators for Iraq. For example, oil production. Well, oil production before the invasion was over 2 million barrels per day. Currently, in 2004, it was just barely reached the 2 million barrels per day mark, and the projection for 2005 is 1.9 million barrels. So somebody's assuming that the insurgents' attacks on the oil infrastructure is going to continue. The actual number of attacks on oil installations in 2003, it was 77 total attacks. In 2004, last year, it was 246 official attacks. 57 of those were blasts on the export pipeline. Oil revenue for 2004 was $20.5 billion. That's the money that came into the interim government's coffers from sales of oil abroad. The projection for 2005 is $21.6 billion. However, let's put this in some perspective. The interim government's budget and the new interim Iraqi government's budget is projected to be at $24.6 billion. So that means there's a $3 billion shortfall there. And I can guarantee you nobody's out there collecting taxes right now. So here we have...
And there's nobody to collect taxes from because the economy is in a shambles.
That's right. Unemployment is extremely high and incomes are extremely low. So here we have the interim government with a need of $24.5 billion, but oil revenue, which is supposed to be the main funding mechanism for the Iraqi government, is about $3 billion short of that. So I think Mr. Wolfowitz has some more explaining to do. And then I have one more number for your enjoyment. The Pentagon said this week that it had trained between 120,000 and 140,000 Iraqi police and soldiers. However, the Government Accountability Office, which is Congress's research arm and is nonpartisan, said that those numbers just don't add up, primarily because the Pentagon is counting about 55,000 Iraqi police who are not reporting for their jobs anymore. So these are guys who have gone AWOL or who have quit their jobs.
And there's a difference between the police and the armed forces as well.
Oh, there's a big difference between the police and the armed forces. Many folks think that the Pentagon numbers are made up of almost 90% police forces. If you look at the Iraqi Interior Ministry's numbers, various officials in the Iraqi Interior Ministry, which has control of the police, and also the new Defense Ministry, which has control of the army, they tend to come up with numbers for Iraqi troops, trained Iraqi troops that can actually fight the insurgency. Their estimates range from 5,000 to almost 20,000. So that's the reality, folks. The Pentagon's giving you a number of 120 to 142,000 when the actual number of trained troops who can fight the insurgency is much, much smaller.
You know, I love it when I hear this 142,000. The simplest way in statistics to cover the fact that you don't really know what you're talking about is to give a very precise number. So it's 140, not 141, not 143, it's 142. The fact that may be off by a factor of 6 or 8 or 20 is immaterial. But we have this precise number that we're going to give out to the public.
Yeah, to make it look like they actually are doing a count. The interesting thing, too, is that the State Department used to give, about 6 months ago, the State Department was giving Congress estimates of the amount of flak jackets, the number of flak jackets and weapons and telecommunications equipment that they were giving to new Army and police recruits. They stopped doing that 6 months ago. That was in September, just before the elections.
Have they given a reason for that?
No, they have given no reason for that. And I think one of the big reasons they stopped doing it is because it was reflecting poorly on the Bush administration, and it was really showing exactly the number of trained and armed troops that are in Iraq, and that it was a very, very low number and did not match Pentagon estimates.
Well, and not only that, but among the troops that are there, a lot of them aren't getting the equipment that they need also.
That's true, and that's one of the reasons, I think, why you have 55,000 Iraqi police quitting. No. Who would want to go out on patrol without a sidearm, without a flak jacket, without a vehicle to ride in, except, you know, the back of a pickup truck where you're a sitting duck?
Yeah, certainly not any kind of armor or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, last week we were going to cover Lebanon, and we ran out of time, so give it a mention this week.
Yeah, and some more things happened this week, too. In particular, there was yet another installation in the dueling demonstrations saga. This time, it was the anti-Syrian crowd that demonstrated hundreds of thousands of people in Martyrs Square in Beirut. So where we have it now is that after the original anti-Syrian demonstration, there was a pro-Syrian demonstration that was much larger, that was put together by Hezbollah. At that point, the prime minister of Iraq, Omar Karami, was reinstated. He had after the original demonstration, resigned his position. The government had fallen. The parliament asked him to step back in, and he did. So at this point, even though there's been a much, much larger, again, anti-Syrian demonstration, the pro-Syrian forces still have control of the government of Lebanon. And it's very clear at this point why you had a civil war in Lebanon in throughout the late 70s and 1980s, is because you have, you know, between the Christians and the Druids and the Shiites. You have some pretty irreconcilable forces, and this is why Syria was asked into the country in the first place, and why all of the other concerned parties, including the United States, thought it was a pretty good idea at the time. At this point, probably what is going to happen as Syria starts to phase its pullout is that that Hezbollah will take over quite a bit of the militia security apparatus, and particularly in southern Lebanon. And what this means for any kind of possible democratic reform is anybody's guess, but it certainly does not look nearly as hopeful as it might have 2 weeks ago. So the whole idea that George Bush can wave his wand and democratic reform will sweep the Middle East, it's not quite that simple, and it won't happen quite that quickly or smoothly.
Okay. Well, moving back a little closer to home, the Senate apparently gave the green light for drilling in Anwar.
Yes, it did. It actually has not given the final green light, and to her credit, Maria Cantwell, who took the Democratic lead in fighting drilling in Anwar, is saying she's going to continue to try and find parliamentary maneuvers to fight it. But there was a key vote this week. It was a vote on a provision in the budget that assumed there would be drilling in Anwar, and Cantwell had put forth an amendment to cut the funding for that, and that amendment failed by a 51-49 vote. Seven Democrats voted against, unfortunately, when you have a 55-45 Republican majority. Excuse me, seven Republicans voted against. You have a 55-45 Republican majority. So with three Democrats voting in favor, you had the 51-49 vote. And this, unfortunately, looks like all that the proponents of drilling will need is a majority vote in future parliamentary proceedings in order to finalize the drilling in Anwar. And of course, the House has already been solidly in favor of drilling Anwar for the last several years. It's been the Senate that has been the roadblock to this. This is a really discouraging vote in terms of the environmental movement, and the Democrats, which have really made this a centerpiece of their environmental opposition, really since the beginning of the Bush administration. This is something that the Bushies have been trying to push through ever since the year 2000, and they've finally gotten it. It looks very likely at this point that there will be drilling in Anwar, even though there won't be much oil coming out of it, even though there's an enormous risk to the wildlife up there, and even though it is supposed to be a wildlife refuge. This is really also a discouraging precedent in terms of the ability of the government in the future to drill or do mineral extraction or various other resource extraction in national parks, national wildlife refuges, you know, these sorts of areas that have been previously set aside from that kind of exploitation.
All right, and moving along, there was developments with a very large corporation that had some problems.
Yeah, first we got the bad news with drilling in Anwar. Now we get some good news. Former CEO of WorldCom, Bernard Ebbers, was convicted this week on 9 counts, including securities fraud and lying to accounting regulators over the enormous fraud that occurred at WorldCom. Folks might have to remember back a little bit to early 2001, before September 11th, when the Enron scandal broke, and shortly afterwards, the Enron scandal was dwarfed by this enormous accounting fraud, $11 billion at WorldCom, which brought down one of the country's biggest businesses and led to an enormous loss by shareholders of WorldCom stock. And I'm not talking just about rich shareholders. I'm talking also about people like retirees with money and pension funds lost out when the WorldCom collapse came. And some folks might also say that the Enron and WorldCom collapse led to the big problems in the stock market as well. That's still debatable, but some folks lay the blame right at the feet of these guys. Bernard Ebbers, finally, here it is, 2005, he's finally had his day in court, and the jury came out with a verdict of guilty on all counts. Now, the interesting thing about this, if you read the articles in the newspapers, is they talk a lot about how it was a little showdown between Bernard Ebbers, the CEO, and Scott Sullivan, who was the chief financial officer of WorldCom, who just before his trial pled guilty and turned state's evidence and decided he would give evidence against Bernard Ebbers. Now, Scott Sullivan has been portrayed in the press as being highly unreliable. They say he's a cokehead. He had run up a lot of debts, and he'd lied a lot about his involvement in the scandal. That all of that may be true, may not be true, I don't know. But that's not what the jury took into consideration when they convicted Ebbers. In fact, most of the members of the jury said that Scott Sullivan's testimony, even though it's making the news in the newspapers, was not the deciding factor. The deciding factor was the documentary evidence, the paperwork. This is something that isn't a glamorous thing, but I find it highly encouraging that people, that a pool of juries, including a bus driver, you know, secretary, these folks can sit down, they can look at the financial statements of a large corporation, they can see the copy that was sent to Bernard Evers on special lined paper in big print so that he could read it and that and know that he did read it and see for themselves that the adjustments on the company's own financial statements were large, questionable, and he should have known what was going on. They can see for themselves the emails that were CC'd to him with from people who had questions about the adjustments and problems with how the finances were going. They can see the videotapes of him giving talks to groups of people in the industry, talking about how his company was structured and about how and about the management of the assets of the company. And they can make the decision for themselves that this guy wasn't clueless. He knew exactly what was going on. And I find that highly encouraging. And I also thought it was an incredibly good news. Now, Evers is guilty. Has been declared guilty now, and his lawyer said that they're going to appeal, but I don't think they have a very good case. I mean, this was a very, very good verdict. The jury was very careful, and the trial went very well. Evers is scheduled to be sentenced in June. And we don't know, I don't have an estimate for how many years he's going to get in prison. The maximum sentence for all these charges is about 80 years, 80 or more years. But it's anybody's guess how many he's going to get and how many he's going to serve. We'll just have to wait and see.
I have to say that it's really quite amusing to me that, you know, if you have ordinary, you know, bus drivers and proletariat who can sit down and understand all these financial statements and these intricate documents, number one, it's an argument against writing anything down. But beyond
I think
that,
that's the lesson for some of the CEOs in corporate America that right now
that,
firing up their shredders.
Yeah, but beyond that, I mean, why are these CEOs getting these enormous salaries if this is information and data that anybody can understand?
Well, the interesting thing in this case, too, is that Bernard Evers, he was paid, one of his large pieces of his compensation was WorldCom stock. He also had $400 million in personal loans that was secured by that WorldCom stock, and which provided an enormous incentive for him to force the company to hit its numbers, to hit its budget numbers every quarter, regardless of whether the company actually did or not. And that was one of the big things they took into consideration when the jury took into consideration when they were looking at the evidence. Now, I don't know how he ran up $400 million in personal debt, but I find that kind of interesting.
Well, and you also have this is what one of the things that came up when they were talking about reforms in 2002 was the incentive that stock options play in compensation for these CEOs.
Yeah.
That they have an incentive to cheat, that they have an incentive to cut corners because they're directly benefiting through the value of the stock.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. That's one of the things that is figured into some of the discussions about changing how companies can pay their employees. Should they be able to pay CEOs in company stock? Now, many companies argue that that gives the CEO incentive to push the company harder to meet its numbers. And, of course, we're seeing the downside of that. So right now, there are no regulations that prevent that yet, but I think that's a good goal.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Oh, can I say one word on Terry Schiavo? Living will. This is why you have a living will. So that you don't let neoconservatives take control of your life like this.
Yeah, or
it's
your
very
body
sad.
Once your soul has left.
Yeah.
Quickly, where do people find Eat the State?
It comes out every couple of weeks. Volunteer publication that you can find where you get free publications at bookstores and cafes and so forth. You can also find us on the web, past and current issues, at www.eatthestate.org. And please come to the rally this afternoon.